It's Thursday, May 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd, reporting from Washington. Coming up, Osama bin Laden's secret letters are released by the U.S. government. Some big banks are hit with big fines.
We're here to announce a major law enforcement action against international financial institutions that for years participated in a brazen display of collusion and foreign exchange rate market manipulation.
Can you clone a woolly mammoth? Some scientists say yes and no. And comedian David Letterman prepares to say goodbye to his hit television show. That's all ahead on VOA's International Edition. The U.S. government has released scores of documents it said were recovered during the 2011 raid in Pakistan that killed al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence said the material included personal letters to bin Laden's family, instructions to his lieutenants, and even how and when to use the Internet. VOA's Jeffrey Young spoke to Seth Jones, the director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND, about what the release of these documents means.
What is the significance in a broad sense of the release of these documents? Typically, the intelligence community hasn't given their documents to the public. This time, they're doing it. Why?
Well, actually, this is part of a broader effort over the past several years to provide additional information about the way al-Qaeda's operated. There were documents released from this trove a few years ago. There have also been a number of documents released from al-Qaeda in Iraq. Many of them have gone to the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. These ones, though, were released directly on the Director of National Intelligence website.
Is there something that has changed in government operations or in the way the DNI is operating to facilitate this?
Well, look, we're living in an age where there's more access to information. In many cases, documents get released without the government's direct involvement. They get leaked in the case of Edward Snowden, for example, or with the WikiLeaks documents. In this case, these are documents that provide us a glimpse of the inner workings of al-Qaeda from its senior leadership, from Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and other senior officials. What they provide in this sense is transparency in how the organization operated. Now, it is important to recognize that this is only a very small tranche of thousands and thousands of documents from the trove captured at bin Laden's complex. So it's important to keep that in context and looking at these ones that are released.
We don't know what these documents are at this point. What if there are, for instance, documents that show cooperation or collusion by various governments or various actors or entities? This is kind of interesting because in releasing these documents, might there be some embarrassments?
Well, I haven't seen anything along those lines in these particular documents. There may be that kind of information in other documents that have not been released. Most of this information appears to be communications among al-Qaeda leaders and affiliates in places like North Africa. They discuss issues like the Arab uprisings and how to take advantage of them. So these are really, most of them are strategic-level documents not implicating neighboring governments, with the exception of some interesting information on some of the al-Qaeda affiliates that were and members and family members that were in Iran.
What is the public's benefit by this release? Is there any takeaway to this, or is it just a matter of transparency?
Well, I think it is important to understand an organization that continues to threaten the United States and the West more broadly, and not just the West, but also threaten a range of countries in Africa, in the Middle East, South Asia, and the broader Asia-Pacific Rim. The rise of the Daesh or the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, there are a number of other organizations in addition to al-Qaeda that are providing a threat. The more we can understand these kinds of organizations, I think the better educated the population in these various areas can be. And what you really gauge, frankly, is that this is a social movement. It's not going to go away anytime in the foreseeable future. And that's what people should come away with in understanding.
For more on this story, you can always log on to our website, www.voanews.com. Speaking of our website, for a look at how the Internet and social media are responding to this story, here's VOA's Michael Lippin. Michael, what are people saying about this story?
Thanks, David. Well, I can tell you our report about the U.S. releasing documents recovered during the bin Laden raid is the top story on our website right now, and has attracted a couple of comments from our readers. Some of them don't think it was a good idea for the U.S. government to actually declassify this material. Reader Chris Mary from Abuja, Nigeria wrote, "This is not good for public consumption. May God protect us all." Another reader by the name of Brandon had some advice for U.S. officials, saying, "It's far wiser to remain silent on certain matters, and this is definitely one of them. It's doubtful whether the British government or the Russians would ever release documents such as this." That's Brandon's view. A third reader, Nash Davu from the Nigerian city of Jos, appealed to God to bring peace to the world and to help protect it from all forms of terrorism. Now, the VOA article also appeared on the Voice of America Facebook page, where several users gave their opinions of the former al-Qaeda chief. Urim Urimi Halimi from Brussels, Belgium wrote, "Legends never die, hashtag respect." Another Facebook user, Rajendra Prasad Kandel from the Nepalese capital Kathmandu, had an opposing view of bin Laden, writing, "Terrorists have a tragic end." Well, the bin Laden documents also have been a hot topic on Twitter. Analytics website Topsy says the words bin Laden have been mentioned in at least 46,000 tweets in the past day. David?
All right. Thanks a lot, Michael. That's VOA's Michael Lippin. And we invite your comments on our stories. Just go to www.voanews.com.
What's new from VOA?
Do you still have a vinyl record collection? Some audiophiles say they prefer the sound of vinyl over digitized music. And records are making a comeback among younger listeners. Now a company in Japan is making turntables that can preserve and improve music on vinyl. Laser turntables. No metal stylus touches the record. And the laser sends pure analog audio to your sound system.
Music in vinyl record is more valuable than money.
ELP President Sanju Chiba says that's because analog music is more natural than digitized sound. His company's turntable focuses lasers on the parts of the grooves untouched by a needle. He says the sound is similar to the music of the master tape. The device doesn't come cheap. The base model is $14,000. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's What's New.
And you're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Five of the world's largest banks face nearly $6 billion in penalties for illegally colluding to manipulate prices in currency exchange. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch said Wednesday that the fines were intended to show that no one is immune when it comes to currency manipulation.
Today's historic resolutions are the latest in our ongoing efforts to investigate and prosecute financial crimes, and they serve as a stark reminder that this Department of Justice intends to vigorously prosecute all those who tilt the economic system in their favor, who subvert our marketplaces, and who enrich themselves at the expense of the American consumer.
For insight on this story, our economics editor, Jim Randall, joins me in the studio. Jim, why is this important? What were these banks doing that was worthy of these fines?
Well, we trust, as customers, we trust that the price we get when we buy or sell dollars or euros or whatever is being set by the market, not being set by collusion. And they violated that basic belief. And this is a zero-sum game. If they make more money, that means you and I make less.
U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch said the fines were justified because the prices that we are to expect are supposed to be adjusted by the market. But is this really going to hurt these banks? I mean, these are the kind of institutions like Citigroup and J.P. Morgan Chase and Royal Bank of Scotland that deal with trillions and trillions of dollars every day.
The fines are big enough that they will definitely be noticed, and there's a lot of speculation in the financial press that some of the top executives of these very large companies will get fired or resign or be forced to resign.
How does this affect the overall financial market? Can people trust that when they do these exchanges that they will be actual honest currency-to-currency exchanges?
I kind of hope so. It's hard to say. I spoke with one analyst who said there are technical changes that you could make. It's very complicated, but you could make some technical changes that would make it more difficult to manipulate currencies, and perhaps that might go into effect in the wake of this.
All right, that's VOA's economics editor, Jim Randall. For more on this story, please log on to our website. That's www.voanews.com. Speaking of currencies, top officials of the U.S. Central Bank appeared unlikely to raise the key interest rate in June, as some analysts had expected. Notes from the most recent meeting at the U.S. Federal Reserve show that officials tried to make sense of disappointing recent economic data that show the economy is growing more slowly than expected. The summary was made public Wednesday after a three-week delay. The next scheduled meeting of the committee that sets interest rates is on June 16th and 17th. Coming up, can you clone a mammoth? Well, we'll find out from Roseanne Skirbel. But first, here's Dave DeForest with a look at what's making news.
Here are the headlines from VOA. The U.S. government has released scores of documents it says were recovered during that raid that killed al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. The material includes personal letters, a list of English language books recovered from his compound, think tank studies, technical manuals, and material published by other militant groups. The Islamic State has apparently captured the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says Syrian forces had withdrawn from nearly the entire city by late Wednesday after heavy fighting. Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said Wednesday international inspectors will not be given access to his country's scientists or military sites under any nuclear agreement. He also said Iran will not give in to excessive demands. I'm Dave DeForest, VOA News.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, could mammoth clones roam the Earth anytime soon? And David Letterman calls it a career after 33 years behind the desk. That's all ahead. Stay tuned. One of the summer blockbusters highly expected this year is another Jurassic Park film. You'll remember in the first films, they took dinosaur DNA and recreated the giant reptiles who've been extinct for millions of years. But could you really do that? Could you bring a creature that has been long gone back to life? Well, that's a question that's answered in a new book, How to Clone a Mammoth, The Science of De-Extinction, by author and scientist Beth Shapiro. Roseanne Skirbel interviewed Ms. Shapiro. Roseanne, can this actually happen?
Not exactly.
What is she talking about in this book?
Basically, you cannot clone a mammoth because there are no live mammal cells. So you can't do it. It's impossible to clone it, like Dolly was cloned in the mid-1990s.
Dolly the sheep.
Dolly the sheep was cloned and lived about 6 years. But what she's talking about in this book, and she talks about mammoths, but other animals as well, is that you can take the genomic sequence and that DNA and then take its closest relative, animal relative, which is an Asian elephant. You could insert by cutting and pasting, genetic engineering, if you will, and grow bit by bit this new animal that is something mammoth-like. But to bring back a mammoth, no.
Okay, so is there a move to do this kind of thing, or is this just more theoretical?
There is a group, actually, at Harvard University that is interested in this. But not exactly for the reasons the Jurassic Park idea, to bring back a freak show, as it were. What they're thinking of is if you can bring back the traits of a mammoth, you may be able to engineer those into creatures that are on the brink, endangered, or in danger of threatened or endangered of going extinct.
Now, has this kind of thing been done with anything that we could look at now, or is this just something
This is something that genetics and the science of genetics is working out in that realm, and backbreeding. But you know, you have to ask a lot of questions. Why would you do this? Why would I think that what people are hopefully realizing is that we are a part of nature. We are not the masters of nature. We're finding this out with climate change and how our environments are changing. So why would you really, really want to do this? And the way the author, again, answers that question is that we can help in a conservation way. In that way, she says, it's a very powerful tool. But is there a place for it? How would you know, bringing back species affect ecosystems? And is it even technically possible? They're so far away from it now. It's a long way. But the exercise is worth it, in the sense that they are looking at characteristics of traits that might be useful in helping support species that are alive today.
All right, that is Roseanne Skirbel. You can see her report about this subject by logging on to our website. That's www.voanews.com. And in the search engine, just look for the word mammoth. I'm David Byrd in Washington. You're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's premier newsmaker interview program. If you have ideas for guests or topics, or want to comment on one of our programs, please write to us at Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. That's Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or if you have access to the Internet, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is pcusa@voanews.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
After 33 years, 16 Emmy Awards, and more than 6,000 broadcasts, legendary broadcaster David Letterman is calling it a career with his final show. But what does Letterman's career mean for television and for the talk show itself? To talk about that, I'm joined by Ron Simon, who's a curator at the Paley Center for Media in New York. Mr. Simon, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
David Letterman, what does his career mean for broadcasting and for the talk show format in particular?
Well, certainly David Letterman has had a remarkable career. He begins in the analog television days. In fact, he comes out of broadcasting so that he knew all the rules of comedy and talk show. He certainly learned so much from his mentor, Johnny Carson. But the thing about David Letterman is that then he broke all those rules so that he's the bridge to two different generations of comedians. He's the one who absorbed everything you needed to know for the first era of television, and then he brought a whole new hip sensibility to another era of television.
He also was famous for some of the bits like stupid human tricks or stupid pet tricks or running over blank with a steamroller or dropping something off the top of a building in Midtown Manhattan to see what would happen. Is that reflective more of who he is, or do you think that those were things that you mentioned he broke the rules and so he just did them to kind of wink and stick it in the public's eye a little bit?
No, I think there's a quiet rebelliousness to David Letterman. He was someone who always wanted to push the limits of comedy. And you have to remember that when he began his late-night talk show on NBC, it began at 12:35, he was the first person to ever do a talk show that late. So he was given freedom to develop a different type of way of relating to the audience. Originally, he was told just to relate to the young male college audience, so that he was able to think about comedy very differently. Then he brought a lot of those experiments to a more mainstream audience when he joined CBS in the early 90s.
And it wasn't just comedy. He was also known for his very poignant reflections on 9/11, for introducing his heart surgeons when he had quintuple bypass surgery, and for making a public admission of having had an extramarital affair and apologizing to his wife. There's very few people who would do that, and very few, if any, other talk show host.
You know, the nice thing about David Letterman, you could see him mature over the years. Certainly when he was on NBC, he portrayed himself very isolated, very maladroit at any type of social connections. He was very uncomfortable in his own skin. But during the CBS years, you saw that he took on larger challenges, and he revealed more of himself, certainly with big historical events like 9/11, and also more personal turmoil, whether it be his surgery or his problems with the extramarital affair. But he was able to, I guess, grow more comfortable in himself to talk to the audience about more private, personal matters.
All right, that is Ron Simon. He's the curator at the Paley Center for Media, and he spoke to us from New York City. Thanks for joining us for VOA's International Edition. To see videos or photos from some of the stories you heard on our show, log on to our website, www.voanews.com. That's also where you can post your questions or comments. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Today's program was directed by Tracy Carter. Aydin Erkut was our engineer. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Political turmoil continues in Burundi, with top government officials being dismissed following a short-lived effort by some military officers to take over the government. On May 17th, 5 days after the takeover attempt, President Pierre Nkurunziza issued a decree relieving the foreign, defense, and commerce ministers of their duties. Even as the president made his first public appearance in Bujumbura to show he was back in command, street protests continued there over his plans to run for a third term. Opponents say that violates the Constitution and the Arusha Agreement that was key to ending a deadly 13-year civil war. Announcement of President Nkurunziza's candidacy triggered street protests, which police tried to repress with water cannons, tear gas, and live ammunition. Estimates are that up to 20 people have been killed, hundreds injured, and hundreds detained over almost 4 weeks of demonstrations. Meanwhile, intimidation and violence by the ruling party's youth militia ahead of the planned May 26 legislative and June 26 presidential elections have caused tens of thousands of Burundians to flee to neighboring nations. The United States is deeply concerned by the potential for further bloodshed, including reports of retaliatory violence following the attempted seizure of power. We urge all parties to seek reconciliation and unity over revenge and retribution during this extremely tense period. We have acted to restrict travel for Burundian individuals who reportedly have committed human rights abuses and will consider additional measures against anyone who plans, participates in, or orders widespread or systematic discriminatory violence against the civilian population. The United States supports no effort by the military to take over power by unlawful means. We continue to believe that adhering to the compromises contained in the Arusha Agreement, including its presidential term limits provision, is key to returning stability and unity to Burundi. Thus, we hope that President Nkurunziza will weigh the best interests of his country and his legacy as he considers whether to continue his controversial bid for a third term. His candidacy will undermine Burundi's economic and democratic progress. Some international donors have already cut or suspended financial aid. The United States welcomes the mediation efforts by the United Nations and African Union and urges all Burundian stakeholders to participate constructively to find a peaceful, democratic resolution to the current crisis. We particularly welcome the announcement by the International Conference on the Great Lakes Region of the visit of the presidents of South Africa, Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania to Bujumbura in the coming days to meet with all parties. Burundi has come far since the end of the last civil war that caused so many deaths and human suffering. The United States reiterates its strong support for the people of Burundi at this very difficult time.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome to the program that helped you learn and improve your American English. We come to you 7 days a week with interesting stories from around the world, presented in a way that is easy to understand if English is not your first language. Today we have something special for you. You may remember that the Rana Plaza building in Bangladesh collapsed, killing 1,100 garment workers in April 2013. More than 2,500 other people were injured. Recently, the victims' compensation fund finally reached its $30 million target. The needed amount came from a donor who asked to remain unidentified. All payments from the Rana Plaza Trust can now be made. As we hear from Katie Weaver, many victims desperately need the money as they continue to recover.
Rahana Akhtir is one such victim. She was working on the 7th floor of the Rana Plaza when she felt a strange sensation, like being in an elevator, she said. Then the 24-year-old woman heard a roaring sound. The room went dark. People started to run and scream. Ms. Akhtir fell. Her leg twisted beneath a heavy column. She was rescued from the ruins almost 12 hours later. Ms. Akhtir's leg was crushed. 6 days later, doctors removed the leg from above the knee. The collapse of the 8-story Rana Plaza was the world's worst clothing factory disaster. The voluntary Rana Plaza Trust Fund includes donations from international clothing companies, the Bangladeshi government, and others. The International Labor Organization, or ILO, established the fund last year to compensate survivors and families of those who died. The Compensation Committee gave an update in April on the second anniversary of the collapse. At that point, more than $27 million had been raised. About 70% of the compensation had been paid to about 2,800 people. The payments range in size from about $625 and 9 months of salary for those without injuries to thousands of dollars for other victims. The top official of the Rana Plaza Claims Administration says some people received more than $31,000. The advocacy group Clean Clothes Campaign said only half of the clothing companies connected to Rana Plaza gave to the fund. Those donors include Mango, Primark, Walmart, C&A, and Inditex, owner of Zara. In April, the clothing business Benetton announced a contribution of $1.1 million to the fund. Clean Clothes Campaign had urged Benetton for months to contribute at least $5 million. Clean Clothes Campaign said last week, "This is a huge victory, but it's been too long in the making." The group said the companies involved make a total profit of more than $20 billion each year. Yet, it said, it took 2 years and intense public pressure to get them to provide $30 million. Clean Clothes Campaign said the lack of speedy action shows that voluntary social responsibility is not dependable. More than 2 years later, many survivors are still struggling. Money alone is often not enough. For example, some female garment workers say their husbands took their compensation payments and left the marriage. Others still experience mental problems or physical pain that makes it difficult to work. Rahana Akhtir received treatment from the Center for the Rehabilitation of the Paralyzed, a hospital in Dhaka near Rana Plaza. Last year, she began walking with a prosthetic leg made at the center. The group also gave her a cow and training as a way to make money. The prosthesis causes pain to her leg, and she uses a stick to help her walk. She has trouble pumping water and carrying things. She says she has a lot of difficulties, but still has to try to do something. This is life, she says. You have to move forward. Some of the neediest survivors received additional help from organizations including the International Labor Organization and local and international nonprofit groups. They supply training for new jobs or provide money to start small businesses. 35-year-old Litan Mia was a supervisor on the fourth floor of the Rana Plaza. He was trapped under the ruins for 14 hours. A university student rescued him. Mr. Mia's leg was fractured, and he could not work for 7 months. He says he was under serious stress about how to support his family. Mr. Mia received about $1,200 in compensation and attended a skills training workshop funded by the German aid agency GIZ. He says he used to remember the traumatic memory of the collapse. But after being involved in this business, he is always busy and does not have time to think about what happened. On a quiet street a few miles from Rana Plaza, Shahjahan Salim works in his small shop. The 37-year-old cannot use his hand very well, so sometimes customers get their own change from a plastic box on the counter. Mr. Salim was a supervisor on the fifth floor of the Rana Plaza. He was uninjured in the collapse, but he went back into the wreckage when he heard calls for help. Over 4 days, Mr. Salim rescued 37 people and recovered 28 bodies. On the fourth day, he freed a man by using a saw to cut off an arm trapped under heavy wreckage. Mr. Salim then slipped and fell 4 floors, more than 12 meters. He seriously injured his back. He was hospitalized and then treated at the Center for the Rehabilitation of the Paralyzed for almost a year. Today, it is very difficult for Mr. Salim to walk. With training and money from ActionAid and the ILO, Mr. Salim opened the shop where he works 7 days a week. As many as 200 customers come each day. The store helped him to go ahead, he says. Shah Jahan Saleem says he does not regret going back into the wreckage of Rana Plaza, although it left him permanently disabled. But, he says, the disaster should never have happened. Government should not permit this type of building, he says. We lost many lives. I want to see a garment industry where workers are safe. Widespread safety efforts are going on now in Bangladesh. At the same time, survivors of Rana Plaza struggle and carry on with their lives. I'm Katie Weaver.
You are listening to The Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. We Americans have an expression, if you give a person a fish, they will eat for a day. If you teach a person to fish, they can eat for a lifetime. One way to explain this is that helping people grow their own food is a better way to fight hunger. That is the purpose of an agricultural research organization called Harvest Plus. Harvest Plus is teaching people around the world how to grow what it calls smart crops. Its project in Mozambique is having surprising effects. In 2006, Harvest Plus workers provided orange sweet potato plants to people in 24 Mozambique villages. The workers taught these people how to grow the vegetables. They also explained the importance of vitamin A to staying healthy. Farmers in Mozambique had been planting white and yellow sweet potatoes, not the orange-colored ones. The white and yellow potatoes have very little vitamin A. However, one small orange sweet potato has a full day's supply of vitamin A. A lack of vitamin A is dangerous. Without enough vitamin A, you face an increased risk of getting a serious disease or dying from infections. Around the world, 190 million young children are not getting enough of this important vitamin in the foods they eat. That number comes from the World Health Organization. Economist Alan Dubois is with the International Food Policy Research Institute. He talks about the Harvest Plus project in Mozambique. He says about 70% of children there were vitamin A deficient. They were not getting enough vitamin A.
About 70% of kids under 5 were vitamin A deficient. So you have this huge need for new solutions. If you can do something through agriculture to increase the amount of vitamin A in the diet, you're in much better shape because that's much more sustainable.
Mr. Dubrow says the potatoes had a surprising effect on the health of children. At the end of the 3-year study, the researchers compared the health of children in villages growing orange sweet potatoes with those not growing them. Children living in the sweet potato villages had 40% fewer cases of diarrhea than other boys and girls. Among children under the age of 3, the difference was 50%. According to Mr. Dubrow, showing the impact of a food-growing project on health is very important. Nutrition experts say vitamin supplements, that is, fluids or pills you take in addition to normal meals, can only do so much. Experts are suggesting that linking agriculture and health issues is a natural and effective partnership. They say teaching farmers how to grow healthier food is among the best ways to improve health. Harvest Plus is now helping farmers in other countries. In India, the group is helping farmers grow iron-rich millet. And in Bangladesh, it is helping farmers grow high-zinc rice. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we look at the presidential campaign of 1980 and the election of Ronald Reagan. The months before Election Day in November of 1980 were difficult for President Jimmy Carter. Many Americans blamed the Democrat for the nation's economic problems, including high inflation and high unemployment. Many also blamed him for not gaining the release of 52 American hostages in Iran. About a year earlier, Muslim extremists had seized the United States Embassy in Tehran and taken the Americans as prisoners. President Carter urged all Americans to support his administration during the crisis. As the months went by, however, he made no progress in bringing the hostages home. The Iranians rejected negotiations for their release, and an attempt to rescue them failed. The president appeared powerless. Carter's political weakness led another Democrat, Ted Kennedy, to compete against him for the party's nomination. The Republican Party, however, was united behind a strong candidate, Ronald Reagan, a former actor and former governor of California. Reagan's running mate for vice president was George H.W. Bush. Bush had served in Congress and as head of the Central Intelligence Agency. He had also represented the United States as ambassador to China and to the United Nations. The inability of the Carter administration to solve the hostage crisis and other problems made many Americans feel that their country was weak. Reagan promised to give them confidence once more in the nation's strength. Carter and Reagan debated each other several weeks before the election. To some people, Carter seemed angry and defensive, while Reagan seemed calm and thoughtful.
Next Tuesday is Election Day. Next Tuesday, all of you will go to the polls and make a decision. I think when you make that decision, it might be well if you would ask yourself, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Is it easier for you to go and buy things in the stores than it was 4 years ago? Is there more or less unemployment in the country than there was 4 years ago? Is America as respected throughout the world as it was? And if you answer all of those questions yes, why then I think your choice is very obvious as to who you will vote for. If you don't agree, if you don't think that this course that we've been on for the last 4 years is what you would like to see us follow for the next four, then I could suggest another choice that you have.
On Election Day, voters gave Reagan a huge victory. It became known as the Reagan Revolution. Inauguration Day was January 20th, 1981. Ronald Reagan became the nation's 40th president and, at 69, the oldest ever elected. In his inaugural speech, the new president talked about the goals of his administration. A major goal was to reduce the size of the federal government. Reagan and other conservatives believed that the nation's economy was suffering because of high taxes and unnecessary laws. Government, he said, was not the solution to the problem. Government was the problem. He urged Americans to join him in what he called a new beginning.
The economic ills we suffer have come upon us over several decades. They will not go away in days, weeks, or months, but they will go away. They will go away because we, as Americans, have the capacity now, as we've had in the past, to do whatever needs to be done to preserve this last and greatest bastion of freedom.
Ronald Reagan was born in 1911 in the small community of Tampico, Illinois. He was a good student and a good athlete. While in college, he became interested in acting. But he did not have enough money to go to New York or Hollywood to study to become an actor. Instead, he tried out for a job as a sports announcer on radio. A radio station in Davenport, Iowa, liked his creativity and gave him the job. Later, Dutch Reagan, as he was called, worked at a radio station in Des Moines, Iowa, and then he moved to the big city, Chicago, where he worked as an announcer for the Chicago Cubs baseball team. In March of 1937, the Cubs were in California for spring training. Reagan went along, and while he was there, he took a screen test with Warner Brothers. The movie studio liked the friendly, handsome young man and offered him a job. Before long, Ronald Reagan was a Hollywood star. In the 1940 film Canute Rockne, All-American, Reagan played Notre Dame University college football player George Gipp. His deathbed speech contained a line that would often be associated with the Reagan presidency.
Ask them to go in there with all they've got. Win just one for the Kipper. I don't know where I'll be then, but I'll know about it. I'll be happy.
In King's Row, Reagan played a double amputee who had lost both legs.
Randy! Randy! Where's the rest of me? Randy!
Yes, Drake?
It was that accident.
Yes, dear. But don't talk about it yet.
He remembered King's Row as the film that made him a star. During World War II, Reagan joined what was then the Army Air Corps and made training films. Reagan became deeply interested in politics during his years in Hollywood. He started out a liberal, but his political views became increasingly conservative. He served six times as president of the Screen Actors Guild, a union of movie actors. After the war, Reagan guided the Screen Actors Guild through a frightening time for actors and others in the entertainment industry. It was the time of the powerful House Un-American Activities Committee. Its hearings resulted in the feared blacklist. The blacklist was responsible for hurting, even ending, the careers of many in the film and television industries if they were thought to be communists or to have communist sympathies. It was through the blacklist scare that Reagan met his second wife, Nancy Davis. Her name had mistakenly been confused with that of another actress, causing it to appear on a blacklist, and she sought Reagan's help in correcting the mistake. They fell in love, and would marry in 1952.
Must be a big push this time, Dace.
The Admiral told me not to tell.
Reagan and Nancy Davis appeared together in the World War II drama Hellcats of the Navy, in which he played a naval officer and she a Navy nurse who loved him.
The Admiral should have told me not to worry.
I thought we settled all that about you and me.
It won't stay settled, Case. Not until you tell me you stopped caring.
By the early 1950s, Reagan stopped appearing in movies and turned instead to a new medium, television.
And every Sunday night, General Electric brings you the finest motion picture stars on TV.
For many years, Ronald Reagan was the commercial spokesman for General Electric and host of a series of dramatic shows. For much of his life, Ronald Reagan was a Democrat. But by 1960, he was making speeches for conservative Republican candidates. In 1966, he became a candidate himself. He ran as a Republican for governor of California. Democrats did not take him seriously. They made fun of some of his movie roles, as in Bedtime for Bonzo, a comedy where his co-star was a chimp. But Reagan had the last laugh. He won the election by almost a million votes. As governor, Reagan was praised for reducing the state's debt, but criticized for raising taxes. Some people also thought he reacted too strongly against student unrest on college campuses. But he won re-election in 1970. In 1976, Reagan ran for the Republican presidential nomination. He came close to winning that nomination away from President Gerald Ford. After accepting the nomination, Ford asked Reagan to share the stage with him. The strong welcome that Reagan received was a clear sign of his future in the party. That future would come just 4 years later when Reagan won the presidency. On Reagan's inauguration day, Iran finally released the hostages it had been holding for 444 days. Walter Cronkite paused in his CBS television coverage of the inauguration for this breaking news report from Dan Rather.
Walter, according to our CBS News sources at Tehran Airport, one of the two Algerian jetliners is taxiing, or was just a few moments ago. Now, as best we can make it out, here is where the situation with the American hostages stands at this moment. They remain in Tehran, at least they were up until just a few moments ago, at the airport, apparently moments away from their flight to freedom, a few moments after spending 444 days in captivity. And can you imagine what it must have been like inside that airliner for the hostages this morning?
As president, Ronald Reagan quickly began work to get Congress to reduce taxes. He also began a weekly series of radio broadcasts. Each Saturday, he would comment on developments in American life and politics. Reagan's ability to relate to people earned him the nickname the Great Communicator. 2 months after he took office, Ronald Reagan was shot while leaving an event at a hotel in Washington. In the first moments, no one realized that he had been hit, but there was a bullet in his left lung, close to his heart. At the hospital, Reagan jokingly told the doctors, "I hope you're all Republicans." They were able to remove the bullet, and he made a full recovery. The gunman, 25-year-old John Hinckley Jr., was sent to a mental hospital. His explanation for the attack was that he was trying to impress the actress Jodie Foster. We'll continue the story of the Reagan presidency next week. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.